The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Let me begin with a quote that you've probably heard, the quote, "All power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely." It's close. As I've looked up that quote originally by Lord Acton, an English lord, written in a letter in 1887, power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You may want to think, is that right? And if he's right, who would we trust with power? Now, another quote on that issue from Abraham Lincoln. He said this: "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." Why? Power shows what you're really like, or gives opportunity to show that. Well, Robert Caro, who's an American journalist and has written a number of books on Lyndon Johnson's presidency, said this: "We're taught Lord Acton's axiom, all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I believed that when I started these books, but I don't believe it's always true anymore. Power doesn't always corrupt, power can cleanse. What I believe is always true about power is that power always reveals." So if you want to know what someone's like inside, what their character's really like, put them in charge or give them power. Now, what's that got to do with what we're doing today? We're working our way through Matthew's Gospel week by week. We come to chapter 4, and the first half of chapter 4 is all about Jesus and what is his character, what has he come to do. And we saw last week, chapter 3 finishes with the statement from heaven that he's the Son of God. But what's the implications of that? That power and that prestige and that, yes, but what will he do with that? So inside your program is the end of chapter 3 and the beginnings of chapter 4. Before we get to that, I need to kind of get you up to speed on something that's a little complicated, but let me try and explain it. What we've seen the last few weeks is that Matthew's showing us Jesus has come to reform or remake the people of God. And so Matthew, particularly out of the four different gospel writers, shows us that there's a whole lot of parallels between Jesus' life and how he begins things and the life of Moses and the beginnings of Israel. Now, if you've read the book of Exodus in the Old Testament, Exodus and the next few books, that'll make more sense. Let me give you really quickly an idea. Matthew shows us that Jesus and Moses are both born under a tyrant, Herod the Great and Pharaoh. A tyrant who'll even kill baby boys to try and stay in power. We saw that. And then God brings Moses and the nation of Israel out of Egypt. And then at a certain age, God brings Jesus back from Egypt. And then Israel spends 40 years in the desert because they won't learn the lessons about trusting God and faith and obedience. And then guess what today? Jesus spends 40 days in the desert learning the same lessons. And then we'll come to it. Moses goes up onto the mountain and he's given the law. Jesus goes up onto the mountain, gives a sermon on the mount. But it's the 40 years in the wilderness and the 40 days in the desert that are significant today. Got it? I'll settle for half the heads nodding. How about that? Does that make sense? Ah, excellent. Good work. Okay. Makes the speaker feel warm when, at least at the end of the intro, people are with you. All right. Let's have a look. You see the end of chapter 3 in Matthew. See what it says? There's the affirmation from heaven that Jesus is the Son of God. As soon as Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist, as we saw, he went up out of the water. At that moment, heaven was opened and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased." Now the next story is about what's the implications? How will he use that privilege, that title, that power of being the Son of God? Then Jesus, 4 verse 1, then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. You notice the New Testament assumes, the New Testament teaches that the devil, this spiritual being, is real and to some extent powerful. And there was a kind of, there's a spiritual arm wrestle going on here up to the point that God allows. One other thing to say, in 4 verse 1, you see the word tempted. In the original language it was written in first century Greek, the word peirasmos can mean tempted or tested. Right? Tempted or tested. There's a slight difference in English, but in the original, one or the other. And you've kind of got to work out from context what's the best English word to put in there, tempted or tested. And it actually works both ways here. Jesus is taken out into the desert to be tempted, yes, or tested in terms of his willingness to trust his Father. Where did this happen? Well, tradition has it that it happened on the Mount of Temptation, as it's called, near Jericho. I saved this news clipping from a few years ago. Legwork removed from the spiritual path. The good news is that a group of entrepreneurs have worked out that it takes much too much effort to walk all the way up the mountain. There's the Mount of Temptation. There's a monastery there that's been going for centuries. But they've started a cable car. So then in just 20 minutes, you can get up the Mount of Temptation, have a look around. You can stay in a 3-star hotel on the mountain, and you can eat in the Mount of Temptation restaurant. Isn't tourism a wonderful thing? Jesus doesn't get to eat in the restaurant, as you'll see in verse 2. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry, of course. And then comes the first temptation or testing. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." And you notice that little phrase in there, "if you are the Son of God." It's not so much prove to me that you're the Son of God. You might almost say, since you are the Son of God, or because you're the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. Now, we know that Jesus, as the story unfolds, we know Jesus can do that. He fed crowds of thousands with a cut lunch, a few bread rolls. What's it all about? The question is, will he use his power? Will he use who he is to serve himself? And that little phrase, "if you are the Son of God," or "since you're the Son of God," it's used 3 times in Matthew's Gospel. Twice it's used here, a third time I'll show you in a little while. Now look at Jesus' answer in verse 4. Jesus answered, "It is written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Very important to know where that comes from. Well, first of all, it comes from the Old Testament. But let me show you where it comes from. I know not all of us are used to reading the Bible, but if you've read some of the Old Testament, Moses, the great prophet, writes, 5 books, Genesis, but from the beginning of his life, as he tells the story, he writes Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. What's that all about? Well, Exodus is the story of Israel in slavery and then ultimately leaving Egypt, right, coming out in the desert. Leviticus is the story of the sacrificial system, all the laws and so on, how they were to relate to God that's set up. And then the book of Numbers is basically the story of them travelling in the wilderness and why it had to be 40 years, because they just wouldn't obey God and wouldn't learn the lessons. And then Deuteronomy is the big long speech that Moses gives right on the edge of the promised land before he dies, where he tells them, reviews the history, tells Israel what to remember when they're in the promised land, and what they should have learned here in the wilderness. With me so far? Okay. Every one of Jesus' answers, there's 3 temptations. With time, I'm only going to be able to look at 2, I think, today. But each of Jesus' answers comes from Deuteronomy chapters 6 to 8, where Moses focuses on the lessons that Israel should have learned in their 40 years in the wilderness. And it's like Jesus is saying, I've had the 40 days, I've fasted, I have learned those lessons. And Matthew shows that each of Jesus' answers come from that period of Israel. He's doing the right thing. He's the true Israel, if you like. He's learned the lessons. Now, what's the lesson that he's learned? Well, if you turn over the page, I think I've put some of the book of, or Lachlan's kindly put some of the book of Deuteronomy there. The quote about man doesn't live by bread alone comes from a part of Deuteronomy chapter 8, where Moses is teaching them the lesson that they should have learned from manna, Let me read it with you. Remember how the Lord your God, got the context, it's Moses saying to them, remember what happened when you're in the wilderness for 40 years. Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years to humble and test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his command. He humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Why? The story about manna, and it's outlined later on, much earlier in the book of Exodus. The thing about manna was this. God could have fed them in many different ways. You could have had a herd of cattle wander into the camp and then they have meat to eat and they dry it out. Or it could have been any number of different ways. But the thing about manna is this. It was there every morning, yes, but it didn't keep overnight, except on the Sabbath. So what that meant was that every night, except on the Sabbath, 6 days a week, they went to bed with nothing in the pantry. And as they went to sleep, they relied on the fact that God would keep his promise the next morning to feed them. They had to learn that they lived not by just bread alone, but by the word of God, that God would feed them again as they got up and they had manna surprise or fried manna or boiled manna or whatever it was. And what's Jesus saying? He's learnt that lesson, that he will trust that God will look after him. In all of the miracles that Jesus is recorded as doing, there's never one that he does for himself. It's always for someone else, never for himself. Now, I'm not going to have time to go through the second temptation, verses 5 to 7. You may like to read them and have a think about it. The temptation is to manufacture a situation that God has to rescue you from. It looks like faith, but actually it's the exact opposite. It's the temptation to throw yourself off the temple. That's an artist's recreation of what Herod's temple looked like at the time of Jesus. I'm going to leave that one. There may be questions about it in a little while, if you like. But you get to the third temptation in verse 8. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. Now, in the New Testament, the Bible actually talks about the devil as the prince of this world. So there is a sense, up to a point, where God has given control of the world to the evil one. Almost as it's a consequence of how we've lived. And the devil says to Jesus, I can give you all of that glory and all of that power, and like all good lies, it's kind of half true. But what's the invitation? It's that you can have it without suffering. You can have it without being a servant and without pain and without the hard things ahead of you. And Jesus knew the cost of what of being actually obedient to his Father and the mission that he'd been sent on. And you have to say it's a real temptation. I'll show you why in a moment. And yet Jesus steps back and says, verse 10, quoting again from that part of the book of Deuteronomy, Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written in the book of Deuteronomy, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." And then the devil left him and angels came and attended him. But I'd want to say, as you read Matthew's gospel or the other gospels, that temptation of to avoid the pain and avoid the suffering and knowing what's ahead, that you got to say that's a real temptation or a real test for Jesus. He's not made of Teflon or stainless steel. I'll tell you one of the examples, or the clearest example. By the time you get to chapter 16, the disciples have worked out who Jesus is, that he's the Messiah or God's great promised king. And Peter says, Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah," or the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then Jesus begins to tell them what it is that he's come to do. He talks to them about how he will have to suffer and die. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said, "this shall never happen to you." In other words, you're the king, the Messiah. That can't happen to you. You can't suffer. Notice Jesus' answer. Jesus turns and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Now, I don't think Peter had the red asbestos tracksuit on and the horns, and he hasn't become Satan. What's he mean? That temptation to not suffer, to not do the things that are really hard, to not do that that's the words from the evil one. And that's also the way our world thinks. Now, remember I said there were three times in Matthew's gospel where that little phrase, "if you're the Son of God," comes up? Jesus knew when that third time would be. Here it is. Above his head they placed a written charge against him. "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two rebels were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself, come down from the cross, if you are the Son of God." He knew what it would cost to do what he'd been called to do. And it was a test to do it. Now you get to the end of Matthew's gospel. Interesting. The beginning of Jesus' ministry, if you like, takes place on a mountain. And Matthew's gospel ends on a mountain with... Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee. This is after the resurrection, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations," and so on. So you see, he's offered, you know, to rule the world and all authority at the beginning, and yet he knows he has to pay that great price, but at the end he has it in obedience to his Father. I don't know whether you've thought much or understand much about the person of Jesus, but have you ever thought what it cost him to do what he had to do? His family didn't believe him. They mocked him, or they thought he was insane at one stage. Constant conflict with the religious leaders of the day who were trying to trap him. Endless flood of sick people coming to him so that at different times he wasn't even able to eat. He looks out over Jerusalem, the city that he loves, and he knows one day it'll be destroyed because they've rejected him, and he weeps over it. He's betrayed by a friend and abandoned by others and crucified, and he wasn't made of stainless steel. Now, what's the punchline in that? What it means is, if you follow Jesus as we pray, as you can actually know him, if life is tough, if you're struggling, if you're tempted or tested, and I'm tempted all the time and fail regularly, okay? If that's you, he gets it. He understands. Now the book of Hebrews in the New Testament is written to Hebrew Christians, right, to Jewish Christians, and they've begun to follow Jesus, and that's all good, but then things are getting really tough now, and there's a temptation to kind of drift back just into Judaism and abandon Jesus. And so the writer says this, "For we do not have a high priest," meaning Jesus, the one who kind of goes into God's presence for us, "we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who's been tempted or tested in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin." Implication, come and pray to God. Come and ask for help. "Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." If you're a Christian, you don't pray to a distant, uninvolved, uncaring God. You pray to someone, to a Lord Jesus who has been here with us and knows what it's like. And so what do you see in terms of power? He's the one who only ever used power for others, who is ultimately trustworthy. And when he calls us to follow him, yeah, it's hard work, it's tough, but follow him means he's done it all first. Have I had any experience myself of angels? No, not not personally. Interesting, in the New Testament, the word angelos can be angel, can also be messenger. So there's occasions in the New Testament where it's hard to know whether is this kind of the supernatural angel who turns up or a messenger from God. I think one example of that. There are others who say they were sure that God had sent someone, or someone had kind of, it was a supernatural thing that someone turned up to help them, to look after them. It may have happened, and I'm just too much of a boofhead to notice as well. Did you want to make a comment further?
Well, no, I mean, they entertained angels unawares. And so it's worth asking.
Yes.
Yes. You don't know who you're taking, really, do you?
So God has his hand in everything, and God sends people to care. Or God, the New Testament says God has angels or messengers who care for his people.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah. Yep. Any other thoughts, folks? Questions? Yes. Jesus is baptized before he went into the wilderness and he kind of receives God's Spirit. Was he relying on God's Spirit or himself? I was trying to think of the reference where it says that Jesus actually came in and began to preach and teach with the power of God's Spirit. So I think Jesus is certainly the man who walks with God's Spirit, who prays in the Spirit. Yeah, and I guess in a way has the power of God's Spirit. Yeah, certainly. The big thing that he promises is after his resurrection, when he's taken back to be with his Father, is that he'll give that same Spirit to those who trust him. Yeah. Okay. Todd. Jesus not having sinned. Jesus not having sinned. One of the big things that the New Testament makes is that Jesus actually lived without sin, that he had done nothing wrong. And so when he gives his life as a sacrifice, it's not to pay the penalty for the wrong that he has done, but for others. In fact, in John's Gospel, Jesus says to his enemies and so on, which one of you convicts me of sin? And they're silent. So, now I don't know anybody else who can say that. But that's one of the clear things the New Testament teaches, that he was without sin. He lived a life of, if you like, perfect trust in God. Yeah. Interesting. Each time, each time we sin, what's the problem? Genesis 3 diagnoses it, that to step outside God's laws or to disobey him is to think through that God either doesn't know what's best for us or doesn't want what's best for us. That God's not ultimately wise or not ultimately good. That's when I disobey him, when I think I know better than he does. But maybe you're similar. Any other thoughts? Yes, sir. Any other time he's tempted? The temptation story is mentioned in Mark very briefly, one or two verses. It just says he was tested by the devil. Mark has a different agenda, if you like, and Luke gives the same story but changes the order. I think the story about the temple, which is in the middle in Matthew, is the last one in Luke. That Luke. I'd have to think about it, but Luke changes the order. I think that's the only time that the tempting or testing of Jesus is explicitly mentioned. It seems to me the greatest time of testing for Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane on the night before he dies, when he prays that he might not have to die, or is there any other way than to have to, his words are, drink the cup, meaning go to the cross. And that's when I think you know, he's sweating, when there's the most pressure on, he knows what has to be done, and I guess to put it bluntly, he's terrified. That's the time of ultimate testing for him, and he chooses to be obedient to his Father. maybe, I don't know if anyone else can, but I can't think of any other time where it's explicitly talked about him being tempted or tested. Was that, sorry?
The disciples might have tested his patience.
Yes, the disciples might have tested his patience. He does occasionally give them a smack in the ear verbally, without sin, of course, when they need it. But yeah, there's often, you read between the lines, he's gone, yeah, yep. Ruby? Can you tell me? Why did Jesus have to be tempted? I think the answer's in Hebrews chapter 2, where it says Jesus is made the perfect Saviour. Okay? And what that means is not that he was imperfect before, but the tempting, the testing, the sufferings, the difficulties mean that he actually lived out the perfect life of obedience, if you like. He stood in our place, did everything that was needed to be done, and then gave his life. I think that's what it is. It's part of him, like he becomes our humanity's substitute, and he lives the human life, if you like, and lives it obediently. If Jesus had just been made a 30-something-year-old, zapped down on the morning for Pontius, I say this carefully, if Jesus had just been made a 30-something-year-old, zapped down on the morning for Pontius Pilate and bang on the cross, there's something missing. He hadn't truly become our substitute and lived out that life, kept God's laws, showed how to live, and then is our substitute. I think that's the answer. But Hebrews chapter 2.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.